And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, a very good morning to you. It is 4 minutes past nine on this Wednesday, the 7th of February. How are you all keeping? I hope you're doing very well indeed, and you're very welcome along to the 9 till noon show. Loads to keep you informed and entertained over the next 3 hours. We want you involved in that conversation as well. 086 60 25 000, that's the WhatsApp and text number, or give us a call on 074 91 25 000. If you want to dial us from outside the Republic, the dialing code, as you, I'm sure you would know, is 00353, and drop the first O. If you want to email, it's comments@highlandradio.com. And of course, you can watch the show daily here on your big screen, your smart TV or your Fire Stick. Open the YouTube channel and type in Highland Radio Ireland and you'll see we're live, and you can take us across your mobile devices on that app and on Facebook, Highland Hub, Highland Radio News and Sports. So tons of ways for you to interact, watch, listen, text, email, and all that jazz. Okay, let's have a look at some of the front pages this morning. We'll start with the Finn Valley Voice. The Finn Valley's main centres of population are not at risk from suspected carcinogenic substances in their drinking water, Ireland's environmental agency has confirmed. But questions remain over water supplies in Lettermacha Ward and Glenties Ardrah, two areas which marginally overlap the Finn Valley. The EPA reassurance came in a week when the European Court of Justice ruled that the concentration of certain chemicals, and on it goes onto the inside of the paper, which I just don't have access to at the moment. Irish Independent continue their study of access to GPs and the cost of GPs indeed. People in Dublin pay up to €50 more for a GP appointment than those elsewhere. There's a significant gap in what patients pay for a standard GP appointment, depending on where they live. An Irish Independent nationwide survey of 275 registered GPs has shown. Now, this is the same questionnaire they must have issued yesterday when they said that a lot of GPs aren't taking on new clients and that there are some quite long delays in accessing GPs in certain areas. Well, the study reveals that most expensive GP appointments was a practice in Dublin city centre for €80, while the cheapest available at a practice in County Monaghan for just €30. On the less expensive end of the scale, one GP in Sligo sets consultation fees at €45, a GP in Kerry charges €40, and a GP in Donegal apparently charges €35. So the average range of GP prices is €35 to €65. So there's at least one GP in Donegal that charges €35 for a consultation, which is, especially if you can get it, it's the one of the lowest in the country. It's just €5 above the lowest in the country. So I'd say that's not the general experience. But anyway, apparently one GP, €35. Inside the Irish Times, former politician turned GB News presenter Nigel Farage said his brand of right-wing politics is growing in Ireland as he praised the size of an anti-immigration march held in Dublin on Monday. Mr. Farage, who was speaking on the Irish Times to the Irish Times on the fringes of the Westminster launch yesterday of former Prime Minister Liz Truss's new popular Conservative faction, also criticised the Republic's political establishments over its handling of immigration. "I've long been surprised that the Irish politics in Dublin didn't represent a lot of the conversations that I've heard travelling around the other parts of Ireland," he said. "But I think that's now beginning to happen." Mr. Farage, the founder of the UK's Independence Party, remains one of the most influential figures in British politics and also finished third in the I'm a Celebrity reality television show in December. He spoke approvingly in London of the right-wing march held in Dublin on bank holiday, for which about 300 Gardaí were deployed. Now, I'm not sure those taking part would, a lot of those taking part would like to be classified as right wing. But anyway, Nigel Farage praised the level of attendance there. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and the EU has set out plans to slash net greenhouse gas emissions by 90% for 2040 under an ambitious target that will test political appetite for the fight against climate change ahead of the European elections. Now, it's a little bit like Groundhog Day, which wasn't that long ago. In 6 years' time, there's supposed to be 1 million electric cars on the road and every other house was supposed to be retrofitted. I'm not sure how much of that is happening. Yes, I mean, more people are getting electric and hybrid vehicles, but certainly not at the levels, and there's not even the charging infrastructure for the cars that are there at the moment. And at the same time, there are serious question marks over retrofit proposals. We're seeing a massive pushback from the farming community across Europe if the powers that be go after them to try and address these targets. So where else is there left to turn? Building all the wind power, wave power is not going to reach these targets. These cuts have to come from somewhere. But my point being anyway is here we go, 90% by 2040, yet it seems that any of the targets they've set for even 2030, they're going to fall well short. So my point being, it just sounds like the same story over again and nothing will come of it eventually. But anyway, I must read on because these are the things people are talking about. While the overall target was within the range recommended by the bloc's official climate science advisors, the EU executive weakened part of the recommendation concerning agriculture in response to weeks of protest by farmers angry about European green rules, among other complaints. So we did see farmers driving into Letterkenny on the hard shoulder there the other day. In France, what they're doing is they're putting silage and slurry into businesses in front of the Eiffel Tower, piling bales of hay, as I said, slurry. The Spanish are doing the same there. It'll be interesting to see with the, at the moment, softly approach of the Irish farmers. And that's not a criticism, by the way. But obviously what the European, mainland European farmers are doing is making a difference in terms of policy. Will we see the same sort of changes in policy here with the Irish farmers taking a slightly softer approach, if that makes sense? A previous draft of the EU target had said agriculture would need to cut non-CO2 emissions by 30% by 2040 and 2015 levels to comply with the overall climate goal that was removed from the final draft. Okay. So I presume if they're going to make cuts, they'll have to make them across Europe, and some countries will see a greater impact than others will. That's the kind of point I was making. Into the Star now, and a GEA all-star who's expecting her first baby with her wife is urging more male inter-county players to come out as gay. Geraldine Doherty, who's 37, said she believes male players are still fearful of coming out in the GEA community, which she says is very accepting. The former Meath Ladies Gaelic Football Association player is one of a few female selectors in the country after she took on the role with the men's team at her club, St Alton's. She was previously a selector with the ladies' team in Dunshaughlin. I always found the GEA to be so equal and so inclusive. My sexuality was never an issue. The GEA was such a safe place, and it was my safe place, said the former forward, who won an All-Ireland in 2005. If I was ever struggling in myself, I'd go to a football training that night and all my troubles would be gone away. So she says more fellas, if they're gay, should come out. But I suppose that's her story. But I suppose it's up to each individual, isn't it, really, what they decide to do. But I suppose she's not saying otherwise, but she's saying it is a... she's saying it is a welcoming place. We're going to get some sleet, snow over the next couple of days. There was speculation back some time ago, and it's come to pass. The long-range weather forecasts were pretty accurate. Reading from the Irish Daily Mirror here, cold weather is forecast to make a bitter comeback as Ireland's recent mild temperatures plummet and snow is coming. Met Éireann says thermometers will drop as low as -3 with wintry flurries affecting many areas. Three separate status yellow snow and ice warnings were issued yesterday. Tonight's expected to bring rain and sleet across Munster, Connacht and Leinster, and snow is possible, while more is likely to fall on Thursday in Ulster. In the first status yellow snow and ice alert, which applies to Connacht plus Cavan and Monaghan, there are warnings about hazardous driving conditions. And then, of course, that yellow was extended to Donegal for Thursday. So some potentially difficult driving conditions on Thursday into Friday there. And finally, parents' fibs folly. Children who are lied to by their parents are more likely to turn into fibbers, the study shows. The link was found to be strongest in those told untruths to get them to change their behaviour. But even white lies were enough to turn a child into a fibber. The findings are from a study of 564 children in Singapore The doctor involved said, "The bad news is for parents is that sometimes honesty may be the best policy." But I remember back from my youth, when we lived in a more urban area, that parents used to tell their children that when the ice cream van was making its noise, you know, when the music was coming, that meant that they'd sold out of ice cream. And that was a warning that there was no more ice cream left. So every time it come around, you could hear the ding, 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 ding. And it's like, oh, no, they've run out of ice cream. What's the best fib you've ever told your children or you were ever told as a child that you believed? I actually thought my parents, now this wasn't a lie, but I thought my parents' name was Mum and Dad. Genuinely did right up until I was certainly in double figures. So I was asked what was their names at school, and I says, Mum and Dad, which obviously went down well with the classroom bullies. But anyway, what fibs have you told? What fibs were you told? Let us know. 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000. It is the 9 till noon show, and we'll be back with more on the programme in just a couple of moments. Stay right where you are. Okay, you're very welcome back to the 9 till noon show, and we're joined in a studio now by Ben Harkin, author of Time Nor Tide, Ireland and Climate Change. A very good morning to you, and thank you so much for calling in. Good to see you.
Morning, Greg. How's things? Thanks for having me.
Good. Talk to us a little bit about Time Nor Tide, Ireland and Climate Change.
Well, Time Nor Tide was a book I wrote a couple of years ago. It was in 2020, about climate change, about I suppose that what's causing it in Ireland, what are the effects that we can expect, and I suppose what we can do about it as well. So I was looking at agriculture and electricity and all the important sectors.
What is the reality of our power infrastructure here? Because I've done a little bit of reading on this, and you know, apparently our plans are very ambitious, but the infrastructure really is not there to match those plans. You know what I mean? And we need maybe a more realistic, honest conversation with the public. What's your assessment of what's being proposed and how achievable that might be?
Yeah, there's big ambitions. So there is, and I suppose there's nothing wrong with ambition, but we need a plan to get there. I suppose infrastructure is the key word. At the minute, we have a lack of infrastructure for our grid. So we all know Donegal, for example, generates a lot of wind energy, but I think around 15-20% of that wind energy last year went to waste because we couldn't actually move it around the country. So we don't have that infrastructure to move it. We don't have the battery capacity even just to hold it for a couple hours. So that's something that we need to get to grips with if we plan on using more renewables. As well, we have the problem that, you know, renewables are bringing down our prices. They're saving us, you know, I think 1.6 billion between gas and coal last year. But then when the wind stops blowing in that, we need fuels to keep us going. And then we're using expensive coal generators to keep us running, you know, and that's sort of cancelling out the effect of a lot of the wind, you know, especially there during Storm Isha, during a lot of the nights. Electricity was basically free with the amount of wind energy we're producing. But to keep the power going during the day, we had to use coal on that, which was really, really expensive. And that's keeping bills high for people like you and me.
Is there a realistic battery storage option that we're simply not using? Or like, is that technology there?
The technology is there. Like in the UK, they use it an awful lot. So they have these markets set up that just make sure that there's that the grid stays stable. And that just means that you don't have to turn on, for example, a gas generator, you know, to keep you going for an hour. You can use batteries. They won't keep you going for days at a time, you know, but they'll keep you over them sort of short periods. I suppose when we're looking at longer periods, I suppose I've been writing recently about how perhaps it's time to take a look at nuclear energy in the future, because I suppose it is a lot cleaner, and as well it provides that stable source of energy that gas and coal are currently giving us.
Yeah, but we kind of ruled that out in the past. Do you think that's something we should revisit?
Yeah, so there was proposals to build a plant in the 70s, the government proposed it, and then there was a visceral nationwide reaction to it. There was concerts and all that, and we ended up actually banning it in 1999, so we did. But we actually can use it today. We import nuclear energy from the UK. We're going to import it from France. But I think that, you know, I suppose there are critics of nuclear energy, and I think that what they say is right. Some of the nuclear plants are too big. They'd be a threat to Ireland's grid if they suddenly turned off. But there's new technology that's coming online in the next decade or so. Small modular reactors, they're built in mass assembly units, so they are, and then they're sort of put together. They're a lot smaller, and as well, that means that there's just less investment. You know, the UK is investing massively in bringing these online. Rolls-Royce are making them. And I think that it is something to consider. It isn't something that'll bring a short-term benefit to people, but I think it is one of them long-term plans. Like, we have to remember, I suppose, you know, we decided not to go nuclear in the 70s, and we ended up building the Monee Point power station. And that station, we're still running it today on coal, and it's a really expensive part of the grid that's keeping people's bills high. So these long-term decisions, I think maybe we just need to revisit it.
One of the arguments, because it is one of the debates that comes in cycles,
yeah.
And one of the arguments, and it came from the Green Party, is that given the size of Ireland and the cost and the investment and running it,
yeah.
that we, I mean, there's always export options, I presume, but that it would actually drive up the price of electricity. That was the argument that was made.
Yeah.
But your argument would be on a smaller scale nuclear plant. Like, does it mean that we're independent, or would it actually mean that we'd be paying less for electricity? Because it all, I mean, there's no way a politician could get it over the line saying you'll have a sustained power, but your electricity
is clean,
going.
But you'll pay more. That argument doesn't work. Well, I would say that, you know, what is pushing bills up at the minute is the fact that we're using fossil fuels. And the Green Party is right, you know, the plants, the historic plants that are used are too big. They're too big for Ireland, you know, it wouldn't really work. But that's why I think these smaller plants that are being built deserve consideration. They're, you know, around the size or if not smaller than the gas plants that we use today. You know, like, there's a lot of people who talk about Ireland being the Saudi Arabia of Europe. You know, we're going to export electricity all around the world because we're going to generate it really cheaply. But like, the biggest exporter of electricity in Europe is France. And they generate 60% of their electricity from nuclear. And that's because they know that, you know, every day they're going to have clean, relatively cheap electricity made from nuclear. And then if they make more from renewables, that's great. They're going
to export
it.
Is it really clean, though? I mean,
yeah. Well,
you know what I mean? What do you do with the waste?
Yeah, well, I would say...
I mean, there's arguably barrels and barrels and barrels of it off the northwest coast here, where it's some other country thought they were making a clean product and dumped it off our coast.
Well, like, I would say it is. I suppose another benefit of these small modular reactors is that they can actually run off nuclear waste from other countries. So I suppose, you know, we have, I suppose, that their capability as well. But, I mean, you know, like, 10% of the world's electricity is run on nuclear. You know, it's used all over Europe. The countries with the cheapest electricity in Europe, you know, and the Nordic countries all use nuclear. And, you know, as well, like, nuclear, I think I see it sort of as the air travel of electricity. It's a thing that we get worried about the most, and that's why it's the safest. You know, for every terawatt hour of coal you produce, it results in, I think, around 28 deaths between air pollution and accidents. And that for coal, it's around 2.5, or for nuclear, sorry, it's around 2.5 deaths. You know, sorry, for gas, it's around 2.5, and for nuclear, it's around 0.03. It's tiny for nuclear, you know, and that is because we do put on all these regulations because we are so safe.
But when it goes wrong, it often goes wrong on a grand scale. You know, I don't know what the implications would be in terms of if there were a disaster. And, you know, it's like anything. Even when I'm preparing for a show, I'm kind of preparing for something to go wrong.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
rather, because when everything's go right, it's grand. So what do you do when things go wrong? You know, I mean, you could be talking water pollution, which would devastate the fishing industry, which is already on its knees. You know, if there was a problem in terms of farming exports, even if something wasn't damaged, you can forget about that. Like, we'd be really putting all our eggs into one basket, especially when there seems to be a move towards solar, offshore wind, which would be more, and wave electricity generation, which would be more predictable than turbines. So whilst it's an interesting conversation, if you were to sort of a for and against column, the against column would seemingly have an awful lot more in it than the for column. Now, you might well say that's not the case, but you know, it would be a big gamble for Ireland and what keeps this country ticking.
Yeah, well, I suppose the fact that the reactors, So these things can be sort of put together in pieces. So you can start off really small. But I do think that, you know, all series, like, there is no silver bullet, I think, for electricity. You know, I'm a massive fan of renewables. You know, again, I wrote the book, renewables is sort of the basis of it. But you need to have a long-term strategy. And everything's going to come with trade-offs. You know, I think that the fossil fuels that we use today come with a lot of trade-offs. I think we kind of assume they don't just because that's what we use. You know, we have massive air pollution problems. We're paying massive costs, not to mention, I suppose, the countries that we're buying them from as well. Mm. I think that nuclear works well in Europe. I think that the new technology that we have, that we're going to have, is going to work even better. And, you know, maybe it won't work in Ireland, but I'm saying that while we have this ban, it's, we can't really take that consideration seriously.
But where would you put it? You know, like, where would you put it? And my understanding is it would have to have access to, it'd have to be on the coast, wouldn't it? Because you need massive amounts of water to cool and what have you. What county is going to allow that, you know, that outwash as well that would be there? Not that it'd be radioactive or harmful, mm-hmm. right? But, you know, inshore fishermen would have a say in it, you know, offshore fishermen would have a say in it, coastal communities would, like, where would, could you actually put it? And I mean, that would be, that is quite an important question in this debate.
It's a massive consideration in this debate, and I suppose, like, the government identified the point of Cairnsmore Point in the 70s as being the suitable choice for it. You know, perhaps even where Money Point is located now, you know, we could locate it there. Like, I suppose there is going to be people that aren't going to want it. Maybe you can work with counties to say, you know, we can reduce electricity bills if you have it close to you or something like that there. But we have to think seriously about these problems. If we want to bring electricity prices down, we want to keep them going down.
Yeah, but we were told that if we accept, we were kind of told that if we accept wind farms in our localities, that would drive the price of electricity down. It didn't. It doesn't.
Well, it does, you know.
No, it doesn't. Come here. It doesn't because we've... No, it doesn't, Ben. We've guaranteed the wind energy producers, we've guaranteed them a unit price equal to that of coal or gas generated electricity.
Well, that's only a small percentage of the wind generators. You know, you can see plainly when you look at wholesale prices. You know, if you look at the hourly prices,
but ours is some of the most expensive electricity in Europe.
No, well, like, it is. Like, you know, we didn't use 1.6 billion worth of gas and coal last year because of wind. So the, you know, wind pushes out the expensive generators. That is what happens. Wind is bringing down the price. I know we're not feeling it, but the reason the prices have gone up in recent years is because gas has gone up.
Yeah, and the reason why is the price of green energy is linked to the price of gas-generated energy. That's indisputable.
I don't think it is, Greg. I think you're wrong on that there.
Okay.
Now, renewables are bringing down prices. They're bringing them down now, and they're going to keep doing it. You know, it's important that, I suppose, we just establish now a clean and relatively cheap form of secure energy that we can use in the future to help.
And the argument is, and I think even Eamon Ryan stated it, like, you know, we do need a backup.
Yeah.
We do need a backup, whether it be coal or... So why are the major nations like China, why are they sort of going back to sort of coal? I wonder. Now, you don't have all the answers. Well, maybe you do, but, you know, they're starting to construct again, and they're constructing an awful lot of coal... coal-generated electricity. I wonder why they're not going down the nuclear route.
Well, China actually is one of the major supporters of small modular reactors. They have a state company that is trying to build them. You know, they want nuclear, I suppose. They have a lot of coal in China, and they're outside of the world's carbon taxes, so it works pretty well for them. But China is going nuclear as well. You know, they are going to need more energy density in their big cities, isn't it? And, you know, they are planning and looking at this technology, and they want to build it. And that's also, I suppose, why America is trying to build it faster than them.
No problem. And Ben, this is not a personal question, but I've asked it before of people coming in about talking different things. I mean, are you paid to push for nuclear?
No,
so
I'm
this
not.
Is just your own. No, this is just your own passion.
If anyone would like to pay me, well, I'll take it. But no, I'm not paid.
I can also change my position. I'm on invest. I'm not anti anything. I'm learning the whole time.
No, it's a conversation.
In the course of this conversation, like I feel like I am learning. Yeah. I think it's just what is it? NIMBYism, not in my backyard. It's going to be a toughie. But you believe that. This is a question, not a statement. You believe that whatever direction we're going, all the cards have to be back on the table and we have to have a grown-up conversation about the reality of it. Because I'm just thinking, in an election cycle, when is the right time to talk about nuclear? Do you know what I mean?
Well, it's probably not an election cycle.
Exactly.
It would probably require a new government with, I suppose, new political capital that would want to do it. But yeah, Greg, it's a grown-up conversation about putting all the cards on the table. Like I say, there is no silver bullets, you know, that renewables are going to bring down the price of electricity. They are bringing it down today, but that we need to make sure that we have that stable backup. We're using gas and we're using coal. And I think that, you know, we just shouldn't assume that that's, you know, what we should use in the future.
All right. Interesting, Ben. Ireland's energy revolution, making the case for nuclear. Is that like a paper you've written or is it accessible for those that want to sort of hear a different... Because... One thing that I am a big advocate of is, even if I were like, think what you're saying is ridiculous, you know, like nuclear, are you having a laugh? You really need to sort of at least have a glance over your arguments before you formulate that up. If we are truly going to be free thinking people, you know, doing our research, you do have to sometimes expose yourself to something that you don't fully agree with. So where can people read it if they wish?
People can get that there if they go onto my Twitter, Ben Harkin. You can find links to my Substack there. I post all different articles about energy and, you know, there about nuclear. But you're right, Greg, you know, when I wrote my book in 2020, I didn't even mention nuclear. I didn't consider it, you know, and like you say, you know, you have to, I suppose, take in these opinions, read the papers that you disagree with. And that's, you know, hopefully, you know, we can come together to get some real answers to the problems we have in our grid.
Oh, for sure. Listen, we're not going to get anywhere if we are polarised. We have to debate and discuss where we're going. Anyway, this is not the most emotive of conversations, but it's an interesting one. Ben Harkin, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me. You can check
him out on X/Twitter. Rightio, Donegal County Council has launched a county-wide recruitment drive for retained firefighters across Donegal. Up to 45 new retained firefighters are being recruited to fill vacancies to bring the total number of retained firefighters to 147 across our 15 retained fire stations. Hugh Gallagher is Senior Assistant Chief Fire Officer with Donegal County Council, and he joins us on the programme now. Good morning to you, Hugh.
Good morning, Greg. And I suppose, first of all, thanks for the opportunity to get to discuss this important topic with your listeners.
No, it's great. So I suppose it's great to have you in. What is a retained firefighter and what's the difference between our fire stations, just so we get a full understanding?
Okay, so I suppose at present, Donegal has 147 firefighters at present, and this new recruitment drive will see an additional between 42 and 45 added to that. In terms of fire stations at the moment, currently we have 15 fire stations on the mainland and we have 2 voluntary stations on the islands, with some of the stations, Letterkenny and Buncrana, currently serving at 15 and the remaining 13 currently at 9. So I'd say the purpose of this recruitment drive is to bring the single pump stations, which is the 13, from 9 to 12. And that will allow them then to have what's termed under the new agreement a week on and a flexible week. So the flexible week will be deemed to give them a period of time away from their alerter to take the responsibility off them, while knowing that there is a crew available to have time, as I say, time off with their family, that you don't have to leave family functions, you don't have to leave your work, you don't have to, I suppose, get out of bed at night and things like that. So
this is part of the resolution to the strikes that we saw last year.
That's right, yeah. It's part of the agreement that came in, the WRC agreement that came in as part of that. And one of the things was that there would be an additional 3 people added to all of the single pump stations, and then the stations with more than 12 currently, the local authority does a business case then to maintain that.
All right. I mean, as part of the team that sort of runs the fire service, to have more personnel, it's good for you guys too.
Definitely, yeah, it's good for us. And, but I think, you know, the focus on it definitely has to be in terms of the retained fireman. Mm. Like at present, you know, the retained fireman carries a pager and he's responsible for alert for 24/7 unless, as I say, he's signed off at work. Now, when you take it that, I mean, like, as I say, I previously worked as a fireman myself. So when you take that, I mean, that interrupts, you know, it's part of your mind every single day. And, you know, as I say, when you're at work, you're thinking about it. When you're at home, you're thinking about it. When you're in bed, you know, it's there. It's on your headboard. And once that alert goes, I mean, we try to mobilise the brigade within 5 minutes, as I say, so to get a minimum of 6 to get the first appliance out the door, like within the 5 minutes, it's a massive, I suppose, task on people.
Just pardon my ignorance, why do we have the retained model? Like, why don't we have fire stations that are, you know, that there's people on shift all of the time?
I think just in terms of Donegal, you know, I suppose the number of calls and the risks that's there, I say it's not, it doesn't lead to having a full-time service.
Yeah.
As I say, I suppose, you know, there has to be not to talk about the money side of it, but it has to be value as well, like I say, for local
authority.
Yeah, of course.
No, everything comes down to many elements, including the cost-benefit side of things. Right, so what... Well, we'll start from the beginning then. You know, what are the requirements in terms of, you know, age? Is there
I think
fitness?
The biggest requirement, I think, first that people need to look at is the distance from your station, I suppose. Right. And, like, you know, I suppose in this recruitment drive, we've moved all stations to 3 kilometres. So you must live and work within 3 kilometres of your fire station. And I know that does sound restrictive, but, I mean, like I say, as I mentioned before, about, like, we try to get a brigade out of the door within 5 minutes. So it has to be reflective of that. So as I say, that's that side of it.
Well, stay with that then, because I was going to come to that, but we'll stay with that. So you have to live and work within 3 kilometres.
That's right, yeah.
And in a month, or if, I don't know what the cycle is, you know, under the new agreement, when would that not apply to you, if you know what I mean? So, like, is it a week on, week off, well, 2 weeks on, two?
Well,
so just
as
explain
I say,
that one more time.
The termination is week on and then flexible week.
Okay.
So so you'll have a week on call and then you'll have a flexible week. And the flexible week takes away your onus on you to respond to your pager. So as I said, you know, you don't have to leave your work. You don't have to get out of your bed. You don't have to miss your family stuff.
But if
so,
we need extra units, then?
But if you wish that you want to attend to all your calls, you have the flexible. Okay. That's why it's called a flexible week. You have the flexibility to attend or not.
So it's a week on, week off, week on, week flexible.
Week, yeah.
Okay. Right. So, and then in terms of if you need time off, family holiday, you're at a wedding.
Well, as I say, I suppose the overall year's divided into 52 weeks. And then, as I say, they're like all other employees. There's 4 weeks of annual leave. So, again, that can be booked in terms of that. And then there is the flexibility. If it is your week on, there is the flexibility there to swap with somebody on the week off, say, to maintain the crew of 6.
In terms of remuneration?
Yeah.
What is the
big change this time is that there has been a move to change a lot of the monies earned to guaranteed monies, and I think that was primarily the issue that surrounded it. Like, it was only the retainer payment. Mm-hmm. I mean, if a starting fireman was on and around 8,500, whereas now the guaranteed payment now has moved to over, like, it's almost 19,000. Mm-hmm. It's about 18,950 or something like that. So when you get to that there, but there's also then additional earning opportunities then on top of that. So that would be the basic possible earnings, or the minimum possible earnings that you can earn. But then there's additional things, like there's training, there's special duties, there's community fire safety and stuff like that, that can further increase the earnings that you have.
Right. Okay. So the minimum is just shy of 19, which is quite the advancement.
Yeah. And that doesn't, I suppose, include the changes that will come under the new pay agreements as well.
So, yeah. Okay. So that's incremental increases coupled with the other things. So that's a significant bit of progress. Okay. So then, in terms of we know the rates, we know how close you have to be, we know the working conditions on off, sort of on flexi off. Or flexi week. So what age categories are we talking?
Well, I think, you know, as I say, we have to look at all categories of age first. Having been a retained fireman, I suppose, you know, to join the brigade at a very young age, you know, when you haven't maybe, I suppose what they say now, lived your life, is not maybe the best thing. But like for us, you know, as I say, we definitely take applications from every person. The retirement age is set at 55. It can be extended based on medicals up as far as far as 60. So as I say, we do accept and we look forward to receiving applications from all walks of life. I think for us as a service, you know, the way that we've changed even as a country, you know, we're much more flexible and I suppose movable than what we were previously. So I don't think we're going to get the person that's in at the young age that's going to serve, you know, 35 to 40 years. I think we're going to have to be looking to target the person that, you know, that's 35, 40, 45 and be prepared that we're not going to get, you know, as long a span of life from them. But it's the person that's in the community that is settled, you know, as I say, that isn't going to be going away. I suppose ideally them's the type of person that we would be looking to target, yeah.
You know, with the changing conditions, it's not, you know, I don't think we're exploiting people who want to be very community-minded or have a particular passion. Those people are there, and I think now, rightfully, they're going to be rewarded better for that. What type of person becomes a fireman, firewoman?
I think, you know, with and I thought about this when I applied for it myself in 2011. You know, what would I suit the fire service? And I think what I have learned, every single person has something as a different element to bring to the brigade, and that's why that's why the crews function so well as a team. We're not all unique. We are all unique. There's nobody that we're not all doing the same thing. We all bring our own expertise, our own specialist trait that we can bring us in that helps us in all different situations. So I would say out there, you know, anybody, you know, can be a firefighter. And I think that's important to note, and that's where we want to get across. Anybody can be a firefighter. The level of training that's provided now has been brought up to a QQA level. So as I say, like, you know, you do training on basic firefighting skills, you do training on breathing apparatus, you do training on RTCs, you do specific training on chemical incidents, hazardous materials, and you do specific training on pumps. So once you've completed that, you know, as I say, you have the knowledge to be a firefighter. And then, you know, you work along with the people then that has the experiences, and that's where you gain that.
And I mean, the fire service are first respondents. You mentioned road traffic collisions there, fires. You know, often, you know, very stressful situations. Do you need a certain type of personality? I don't think you ever get used to stuff, but do you need a certain...
I think, you know, where I would come from in that, I suppose, you know, first of all, in terms of the incidents that we attend, we'd run a program called CISM, which is Critical Incident Stress Management, and that deals with, you know, to making sure in terms of the aftermath side of it, to make sure that everybody is aware of what everybody has done, what they have went through, and as I say, you know, we respond as a crew and you recover as a crew, which is extremely important. Now, in terms of the incidents that we attend, and again, I suppose being able to speak about it, and I have been at some incidents like that, you're trained and you have a specific level of training and you have a specific role to do, and you go there and you do that role. And when you have that role complete, everything is effectively done and dusted. Mm-hmm. So you're there, you're not on your own, you're as part of a crew. And when you're doing that, you don't get the opportunity to take on board you know, what people may see, like, you know, if you see something on TV or something like that, where you get a chance to sit and look at it, you're not standing looking, you're doing your job, you're doing your role, and you're helping.
And
that
you go
person.
Into work mode, and you say the training is there.
That's right. You go into work mode.
Is there any women in the fire service in Donegal at the moment?
Not at present in Donegal. Right. And you know, as I say, I thought about this, I suppose, on the way up the road, and it's definitely something that we want to see. We want to see applications from females. We have had applications from females in the past, and they have came and they have done their assessments and they have passed their assessments. And there seems to be, I suppose, the next element, you know, whether it's they have changed their mind or whatever it is. But like, I definitely would like to say, I have in other counties, I have worked with female firefighters, I have trained with female firefighters, and they are equally, you know, as good as the male side of it. And it's definitely something that we want to see in Donegal.
I mean, obviously, you don't want to have a fear of heights. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You have to be available there to, you have to be able there to pass the training.
Yeah.
Do you know what
I
mean? There are markers.
And you know, that is part of it. I mean, your first step in the recruitment side is to fill in your application form. And once you submit that, then everybody's invited then to Letterkenny Fire Station, which is the headquarters of the county, to do recruit assessments. And they're set out around six different skills. And them skills basically determines, you know, are you suitable for the fire service? And one of them includes climbing the 13.5 ladder to the top of the tower.
No bother.
So, no bother. Yeah.
And like, say, for instance, would you advise someone who's interested in applying to speak to their employer first?
Well, because, in terms of the employer, and I think like that's a very important point that you bring up, you know, and I suppose from my own perspective, what I would be saying to them is definitely speak to your employer. You know, primarily most of our calls is evening times, nights and weekends. So the impact that it has on the daily work and life of a person is extremely limited. Like surely there's periods of time, particularly in Gorse Fire, you know, where things can maybe get a slightly, you know, more busier for a very short period of time. But I think, you know, and first of all, I suppose, thanks to the employers that currently employ firefighters from Donegal, but as I say, that is a massive thanks, I suppose, from the county. But in terms of existing or new people that wants to apply, I mean, I would you know, urge employers to consider not just the negative side that this person might be attending a call, you know, every so often, but the training that they bring, the speciality that they bring to their person, you know, in terms of the training that they provide. I mean, the training that's provided by the fire service doesn't stop at the gate when you leave the station. Like, you know, you carry that with you in, as I say, in all walks of your life, including your employment.
A listener is colourblind. Does that preclude them?
It will indeed, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's one of the things. Is there anything obvious beyond that?
I suppose, you know, as I say, the assessments that we provide, you know, so there'll be, as you said, like the height side
quite
of it.
Physical.
There's confined space side of it. There's strength tests, there's fitness tests, as I say, and then there's a reading and a listening and a written comprehension side of it as well, like, you know.
Okay, and if anyone wants to apply in the first instance, well, you can go to the website donegalcoco.ie, where there's an information document which goes through, I'd say, a lot of what we've been discussing, join your local fire brigade. And the application process is open until February 19th, so not that far away, 12 noon on Monday, February 19th. So you're hoping that the likes of this conversation might just plant a seed.
That's right. The likes of this conversation, as I say, you know, I was a fireman myself, so as I say, I'm talking from experience. The job itself, it's more than just a job. It's a role. It's very rewarding. It's very well respected within your community. And I suppose, you know, I would like people to think, like, when they're looking at the advertisements, that, you know, if it's not them that applies, then who's it going to be? Because it is extremely important to have a fire service in your community. From the recruitment side of it now, I suppose we've got a massive social media presence. We will be putting up posters and flyers, as I say, from all stations around the county. And then there's scheduled open nights for each station. And again, we urge anybody that has any level of interest in applying to definitely come to them to the open nights. They'll get a chance to meet the crew. They'll get a chance to see appliances, equipment, etc., and chat to people that are loving the role every single day.
Right.
And I think that's extremely important for them.
Hugh, listen, it's been really interesting and informative, of course, and we hope there's a great response. Hugh Gallagher, Senior Assistant Chief Fire Officer with Donegal County Council. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks so much, Greg.
I'll be back with more shortly. Right, some of your comments as we head towards the news at 10. There isn't enough reserves of battery minerals in the world to back up intermittent wind energy. Mining for wind and batteries is as bad as mining for fossil fuels. It's all digging. We have to change the way we live to slow down climate change, but people don't want to do that. But this is not a counter-argument, but digging and mining is not necessarily the big problem for the environment. It's the emissions, isn't it? And over the course of the lifetime of a car, studies have found, just the lifetime of a car, it's not too long before it is better for the environment than a petrol diesel car, even given the manufacturing of batteries and what have you. I read a study to that regard. Thanks, Greg. Wind has not put down the price of electricity. As for building turbines on peat in Donegal, what nonsense in terms of carbon release in face of climate change. That does seem to be a strange practice. What planet is this guy on? Re-energy prices. We have the highest electricity prices in Europe, coupled to gas prices. These prices are always going to be higher. Irish consumers ripped off. Prices were cheaper before we allowed competition in electricity supply. It doesn't stack up, they say. There is no climate crisis, says a listener. It's proven by real climate experts, not funded by corrupt organisations like the UN, US, EU, WEF, CFR, etc., who bribe failed scientists to provide the results they want to use a controlled mechanism to restrict our freedoms, says a listener. I don't see how it restricts our freedoms, but anyway, that's your view. I think really, if you have a particular point of view, you can find an expert to which you can align those views. Greg, biggest lie I was told when I was younger was that Ireland is the land of saints and scholars. Didn't take long to discover it was a country full of snakes and crawlers. Okay. Greg, my siblings have a lot to answer for growing up as a Connolly. I was told Billy Connolly was my uncle and also would often be challenged to beat my previous time to get a bucket of coal in. Okay. I like that. Any more like that? What was the fibs or lies? We'll stick with fibs. What were the fibs you were told as a young person by siblings or parents that you actually believed for quite some time? This person's name was Connolly, and they were told Billy Connolly was my uncle. All right, okay, brilliant. And on it goes. We have a few more of those, actually, some quite funny ones coming in, so keep them coming in. What was the fib that you believed as a child that you can sort of laugh at now looking back?